At 1:15, Falcon had climbed into the hayloft of the livery and looked down the street toward the front of the prison. From there, he had an excellent view of everyone who entered or left the prison. And true to the warden's word, Frank Childers exited the gate exactly on time. Falcon stayed where he was for a few minutes, watching to see if anyone met Frank. At first, he didn't see anyone there, and he worried that perhaps he had made a mistake. Then across the street, leaning against a telegraph pole, he saw what he had been looking for. Aaron Childers stepped away from the pole and shook Frank's hand. The two men chatted for a moment, then started up the street toward Falcon, approaching the livery. Falcon stepped back away from the upstairs loading window to avoid any possibility of being seen from the street. Standing in the shadows and partially obscured by the stanchion to which the block and tackle for handling the hay was attached, Falcon watched him all the way into the livery barn. He could hear him talking as they came in.
So, who's riding with you now?
There's only the four of us. Me and you, Dalton, and Percy.
Percy's still with us?
Yeah, well, where else would he go? He doesn't have the sense to piss downwind.
Yeah, you got that right.
The horses are back here.
How far is it?
We'll get there tomorrow.
Falcon watched the two men ride through the shadows, then out into the brightness of day. He waited until he was sure they were well clear before he climbed down to saddle Diablo. Falcon walked Diablo out of the barn, then bent down to study the hoof prints left by the two horses. One of the animals had a small nick on the U of the shoe of the left rear foot. The other one had a somewhat larger chunk on the left forefoot. Smiling, Falcon stood up, then swung into his saddle. These two couldn't make it any easier to trail them if they were notching trees along the way. Back at the cabin, Dalton and Percy had switched roles. Percy was now outside, watching the approach to the cabin, while Dalton was inside, keeping an eye on their prisoner. Anna had managed, by continually working with the ropes, to free her hands. Keeping an eye on Dalton, who was frying bacon, she started working on the ropes that bound her ankles. It was risky because Dalton kept looking back over his shoulder to check on her. Each time he did, Anna would quickly pull her hands back up behind her.
Don't you be trying nothing now. I ain't like Percy. You ain't going to get away from me.
Don't worry. I'm not going anywhere. That bacon smells good.
Yeah? Well, if there's any left after me and Percy eat, maybe you can have some.
Thanks.
Dalton turned back to the stove, and when he did, Anna reached down to finish untying her ankles. Freeing herself of the last knot, she stood up very quietly and started tiptoeing toward the door. A knife had hit the wall in front of her. Anna jerked back, then turned toward Dalton. He was smiling evilly at her.
I could have just as easily put that knife in your back. I told you, I ain't Percy. If you try and get away from me again, I'll break one of your legs.
The night creatures were singing as Falcon made a cold camp that night. A cloud passed over the moon, then moved away, bathing the prairie in silver. Supper was a piece of jerky and a couple of swallows of canteen water. He chewed on a coffee bean as he watched the distant campfire. Falcon had been able to trail the Childers brothers by following the distinctive shoe tracks left by the horses. Because of that, it had not been necessary for him to ever close to within visual distance. The campfire ahead of him was theirs. He was certain of that. It was at least a mile away, far enough to enable him to maintain the cloak of secrecy, yet close enough to minimize any possibility of getting him separated from them.
Why are we leaving a perfectly good campfire?
In case McAllister's following us.
McAllister? Wait a minute. That's the son of the bitch who got me, isn't it? Why would he be following us now?
I don't know why. I just know he's been on our ass since the very beginning. And it wouldn't surprise me none if he wasn't following us right now.
I noticed that you've been looking back over your shoulder a lot today. I figured you was just being extra careful.
I was.
So, did you see him?
No.
So, why are you worried?
Because he's like a damn engine. The time to worry is when you don't see him.
Because Anna had managed to get loose twice, Dalton had come up with another way to secure her. He found a small chain and a padlock, and he used that to attach her to the bed. In one way, it was more comfortable for her, because she wasn't as tightly bound as she had been when tied with ropes. Also, the restraint was only around her left wrist, which gave her a bit more freedom of movement than the ropes had, which had bound both hands and feet. It was dark outside, and Anna was sitting on the edge of the bed watching Percy Shaw and Dalton Yerby have their supper.
You dumb son of a bitch. Don't you know better than to fart at the dinner table?
Oh, I couldn't help it. It just come out. I'm sorry about the fart, Miss Heckmeyer.
What are you apologizing to her for?
Women folk like it when men are polite. God, don't you know that?
What the hell do I care what women folk like? I ain't never had me a woman I didn't pay for. And if I pay for her, then seems to me like it's her job to do what I like. Don't you think that's right, girl?
I really wouldn't know.
Case you high society type women don't know nothing about whores. That's where your men folk go because you're so cold in bed.
What are you telling her that for? She's probably a virgin. She don't know about things like that.
You a virgin, girl? I hate virgins.
I'm hungry. I haven't had anything to eat all day.
You want something to eat?
Dalton reached across the table and picked up Percy's plate, which still had a half a piece of bacon and some uneaten beans.
Hey, whoa, wait a minute. I ain't finished eating yet.
You're the one wanting to be nice to her. Don't seem to me like it'd be too much to ask for you to share your food with her.
Percy stroked his jaw, then looked over at Anna.
All right. I reckon that'll be all right. But I'll give it to her.
Percy took his plate back from Dalton and picked up a fork.
Don't give her no fork.
Why not? How's she gonna eat without a fork?
She can use her hands. You give her a fork and she's liable to use it on you.
All right, whatever you say.
He put the fork back down, then took the plate over to Anna and handed it to her.
Thank you.
She picked up the bacon and shoved it in her mouth, then did the same thing with a handful of beans.
Damn! She's really hungry.
It's good for her. Rich bitch like her. She's probably never been hungry in her life.
Percy watched Anna eat for a moment longer. Then he started toward the door.
Where are you going?
I'm going to take a piss.
Long as you're out there, you might as well take the first watch.
It ain't my time for watch.
Take the watch. I'll look out for the girl.
There was something in the tone of Dalton's voice that caught Anna's attention, and she looked up in alarm. Glancing toward him, she saw the look in his eyes.
All right, but when it comes time to relieve me, you better come out there, or I'll come in anyhow.
What do you need to watch for anyway? My father's already agreed to all your demands. Nobody's coming after you.
Anna didn't want Percy to leave. She didn't find Percy's company any more desirable than Dalton's, but she had the idea, perhaps unreasonable, that as long as both of them were here, nothing would happen to her.
She's right. There ain't nobody coming for us. What do we have to stand watch for?
Just get out there and do your time on guard. I'll be out there when it's my time.
Percy paused for a moment, and Anna thought that she saw a glimmer of understanding in him. Maybe if he could see what Dalton had in mind, he would stay. But her hopes were dashed when he suddenly smiled.
You gonna have a little fun with her, ain't you?
What makes you think that?
Hell, I can tell by the look on your face. Aaron told us we couldn't do nothing until after we got the money, remember?
Yeah, and he also said he was gonna be first. Only ain't here now.
Hot damn! Okay, let's do it.
Get on out there. I'll tell you when it's your turn.
I want to stay here and watch.
You ain't gonna stay here and watch. Get on out there, like I said.
Okay, but don't take too long. Damn if I ain't got me a big heart on now just thinking about it. I can barely walk right.
Anna watched Percy leave. Then she looked back toward Dalton. He started toward her. His eyes glowed red in the reflection of the candle, and looking into him was like looking through the windows into the very fires of hell itself.
You don't really want to do this.
Oh, but I do. Yes, ma'am. Me and you's gonna have us some fun.
No. Please don't. Your boss said that I wasn't to be harmed.
My boss? You talking about Aaron?
Yes.
He don't want you killed. Yet. But he was already planning on this. Only his thing is, he wanted to be first.
Oh. Please. No.
Anna squeezed her eyes shut, trying unsuccessfully to prevent the tears from sliding down her cheeks. She smelled his foul breath and his body stench as he sat down on the bed beside her.
Go ahead and cry if you want to, girl. Fact is, I like it when my women cry.
Dalton put his hands on her shoulder and pushed her back on the bed.
No, please don't do this. My father has met your demands.
Don't make no difference to me whether your paw comes through or not. I've been planning on having me a little of this from the moment we snatched you up. Now, the way I look at it is, you got yourself two ways to get through this. You can either cry, fight me, and I gotta tell you, honey, I like that. I like that a lot. Or you can do like the whores do, pretending that you like it, even though you don't. Up to you.
Anna felt Dalton's calloused hands bunching up her skirt, tugging at her undergarments, until she could feel the night air on her most intimate parts of her body. Almost involuntarily, she squeezed her legs together. Dalton unbuttoned his pants and put his hand between her thighs. Despite her efforts to resist him, he forced her legs apart.
There. Now that's a good girl.
Anna felt Dalton's weight press against her bruised and racked body. Then she felt something cold and metallic against her thigh. It was Dalton's knife. The same knife he had thrown at her earlier. She shifted position slightly to allow her to get to the knife.
There you go, girl. I knew he would.
Anna slipped the knife into Dalton's body. She had the presence of mind to know to turn the knife sideways to allow it to slide in between his ribs. She pushed it in all the way to the hilt.
What? What have you...
He got up, then backed away from her, looking down in shock at his own knife protruding from his body.
Well, you bitch! You stabbed me!
He pulled the knife out, and when he did, blood squirted from the wound almost like water from a fountain. He put his left hand over the wound in an effort to staunch the flow of blood, but it spilled through his fingers.
I'm gonna cut your heart out.
With the knife in his right hand, he staggered toward her. Before he got to her, though, he fell. Anna couldn't hear him breathe, and as she looked down at him, she saw that his eyes were open, but already growing opaque. Anna tried to reach the knife, straining forward with her one free hand. She could brush the tips of her fingers across it, but that was all. She couldn't get a hold of it to pull it to her. She leaned back in frustration. Then she saw her undergarments on the bed beside her. Grabbing them, she leaned out again, tossed them toward the knife, and pulling on them, managed to drag the knife close enough to reach it. With the knife in hand, she began picking at the lock, and after a few attempts, successfully got the lock open. She started toward the door, then remembered what had happened on her first escape attempt. There was only one door in the cabin, but there was a window at the rear. Moving quickly, Anna went to the back of the cabin. Climbing up on the cabinet, she opened the window and crawled through. It was a drop of 6 feet to the ground, but she didn't care. Getting up from the ground, Anna brushed her hands off, then crept to the edge of the cabin and looked around. She saw Percy sitting up on a rock, looking out toward the approach. Keeping a wary eye on him, she slipped through the dark to the little lean-to that served as a barn. Because Aaron had taken two horses with him, there was only one horse in the lean-to. If she could get to it, she could not only use it to get away, she would leave Percy without a horse so he couldn't come after her. Anna managed to put the bridle on, but when she started to get the saddle, the horse started whickering and moving around. Looking toward the rock, she saw that the horse had caught Percy's attention. She stepped back into the shadows of the lean-to so he couldn't see her. Percy stared into the lean-to for a moment, but satisfied that everything was all right, he turned his attention back to the approach. Anna moved back out of the shadows, but she decided it was too risky to saddle the horse. She wondered if she could ride without a saddle, then decided why not. She knew that Indians rode without a saddle. Without a stirrup, she had to climb up on the feeding trough to get mounted. Doing so, she lifted her skirt and straddled the horse. That was when she experienced the somewhat disconcerting sensation of feeling her nakedness against the horse's back. She had not put her undergarments back on. Slowly, she guided the horse out of the lean-to.
Dalton! Dalton, where you going?
Anna urged the horse into a gallop, but with no saddle, she was unable to stay on the horse. With the first burst of speed, she was unseated and she fell hard. By the time she got up, Percy was over her with his gun drawn.
God damn it, girl! When are you gonna quit trying to escape?
When Falcon reached the now-dead campfire the next morning, he realized that his quarry had not camped there last night. The fire had been a ruse to hold him in place.
Damn.
He should have come up closer to the fire to see if they had really made camp. But to be honest, he hadn't given Aaron Childers credit for being that smart.
He got us this time, Diablo, but he won't get us again.
Fortunately, their trail was easy to read, so Falcon began following their tracks, moving more swiftly than he did the day before, because there was less a chance of overrunning them, giving himself away. Everything was going well until around noon. A thunderstorm came up, and as the rain poured down, it began washing away the tracks right in front of him. Falcon was about to throw up his hands in disgust when about a half a mile in front of him, he saw two men leading their horses into the opening of an old abandoned mine. Falcon wasn't quite as lucky in finding shelter as the Childers brothers were. He did find a rock overhang that shielded him from some, but not all, of the rain. He got Diablo under as much of the shelter as was possible. Then he pulled his slicker around him and sat as far back under the rock as he could. The rain finally eased up around 3 that afternoon, and Falcon watched as Frank and Aaron Childers re-emerged, still leading their horses. After leading them for a few yards, they mounted them and rode on.
Let's go, Diablo.
When Falcon reached the mouth of the abandoned mine, he saw that the rain that had washed away the old trail actually made the new trail much easier to follow. That was because there was only one set of tracks now. All previous tracks had been erased. Soon, Frank and Aaron reached the cabin.
Percy, where's Dalton?
He's lying out back.
Lying out back? What do you mean he's lying out back? Lying out back doing what?
Lying out back being dead.
Dead? You son of a bitch, what'd you kill him for? He was my cousin, damn you!
Now hold on there, hold on! I didn't kill him!
Well, if you didn't kill him, who did?
She did.
Percy nodded toward Anna, who once again was chained to the bed.
Wait a minute, don't give me that! Are you telling me that little slip of a girl killed Dalton?
That's what I'm telling you.
How could she do that if you got her tied to the bed? What did you idiots do? Leave a gun close enough for her to get hold of it?
Wasn't no gun involved.
Then how did she do it?
She stabbed him with his own knife.
Aaron walked over to the bunk and looked down at Anna.
Is she telling the truth? Did you kill Dalton?
Anna didn't answer him.
This ain't your papa's court, woman. Answer me when I talk to you. Did you kill Dalton?
Yes. He tried to rape me.
Is that true, Percy?
I don't know. I was outside. Next thing I knew, I seen her trying to escape. When I brought her back in here, I seen Dalton lying on the floor dead. What's that smell, Frank?
What smell?
Aw, shit! The shack's on fire!
The room started filling with smoke.
What the hell? How'd that happen? Oh, come on, let's get out of here.
What about the girl?
Where's the key?
The key? I'm not sure. It may be in Dalton's pocket.
Well, I ain't going through a dead man's pocket to look for it. Let's get out of here.
Wait! You can't leave me here.
three men were already out the front door. Anna got down on the bed, burying her nose in the blankets in hopes of filtering out some of the smoke. Then she felt someone's hand on her arm, and when she looked up, she saw through the smoke that whoever it was had the key in his hand.
They were right. The key was on Dalton.
Mr. McAllister!
Come on, we're going through the back window.
Falcon helped her up and led her to the back of the cabin. Then he lifted her up onto the cabinet beneath the already open window. Falcon shoved her through the window, then climbed through the window behind her. Grabbing Anna by the hand, Falcon led her away from the burning building, through a thicket of trees, and onto a little dirt road. Here, a single large black horse stood quiet.
This is Diablo. He'll get you out of here. About 2 miles down the road, you'll reach the railroad. Turn left and follow the railroad for about 10 miles. That'll take you back to Medora.
Wait a minute. Aren't you coming with me? We can ride double.
I've got some business to take care of first.
But how are we going to get to town without a horse?
I'll borrow one.
Mr. McAllister, I can't thank you enough for rescuing me. You truly are a hero.
Falcon didn't answer. Instead, he helped her mount Diablo.
You take care of her, boy.
Falcon started back through the clump of woods toward the cabin. The cabin was fully engulfed in flames now, throwing out a large radius of heat and sending smoke billowing into the sky. Falcon saw three men standing near the lean-to. They had already saddled their horses and were getting ready to ride away. He started toward them.
It's McAllister! Shoot him! Shoot the bastard!
Aaron mounted his horse, grabbed the reins of the two other horses, and galloped off.
Hey! Where are you going with them horses?
Aaron! What are you doing? It's every man for himself!
Percy started running after Aaron. Aaron pulled out his pistol.
Ah! Aaron! You son of a bitch!
Drawing his gun, Frank fired at Aaron.
Drop your gun, Frank. Throw up your hands.
The hell I will! I ain't letting you take me back to prison again!
The bullet nicked Falcon's ear. Falcon returned fire, hitting Frank in the middle of his chest. Aaron was gone. Frank was dead. And Percy was dying.
Why'd he do that? Why'd he run off on us like that?
Because he's a coward. And that's how cowards do.
Well, shit. You know what? I hope that you get that son of a bitch.
Don't worry. I will.
After nearly an hour of trailing on foot, Falcon was pleasantly surprised to see a golden palomino standing quietly in the meadow eating grass. As he came closer, he saw that it was a mare. Was this Douglas's horse?
Rhoda.
Upon hearing her name, Rhoda trotted easily over to him. Falcon began patting the horse on the neck, and looking toward her rump, saw the letter D over an arc. The Rockin' D, Douglas's brand.
It is you, isn't it, Rhoda?
Rhoda pushed her head against his hand, welcoming the attention. Falcon pulled the rifle out of the saddle sheath and tossed it aside, replacing it with his own. He mounted the horse.
Come on, old girl. Let's go find that bastard.
Now that he was mounted, it was much easier to follow Aaron's trail. He hadn't gone too far, though, before he noticed that the horse Aaron was riding had broken stride badly. Reading the sign told the story. In his desperate attempt to flee, Aaron had ridden his horse into the ground. The hour lead that Aaron had on Falcon meant nothing now. Falcon found Aaron's horse about a half hour later. The animal was still alive, though only barely. His nostrils were flecked with blood, evidence that Aaron had ridden the horse until its lungs burst.
I'm sorry, friend.
He patted the animal gently on the neck and looked into its sorrowful brown eyes. The horse seemed to understand what Falcon was about to do. The horse died instantly. Falcon began walking, leading Rhoda, following Aaron's trail. The sign continued to tell the story, as clearly as if Falcon were reading it from a book. Aaron had run as far as he could, then he'd started walking. Then he'd started throwing things away. Falcon found the pistol belt, though the holster was empty, which meant Aaron did keep his pistol. Next he found the spurs, then Aaron's shirt, and finally, an empty canteen. Within another mile, Falcon found indications that Aaron was beginning to have a very difficult time. There were signs that he would fall, crawl a few feet, then get up and lunge ahead a few feet more before falling again. Falcon realized with a start that he was closer to the railroad than he thought. He knew then where Aaron was going and what his intention was. Aaron planned to hop a freight, and if he did, he'd get away.
Son of a bitch!
Falcon remounted and urged Rhoda into a lope up a steeply rising slope. The slope was high enough in front of him that it obscured his view of the other side, so though he could hear the train, he still couldn't see it. It also made it more difficult for Rhoda.
Don't give up on me now, girl.
Finally, Falcon reached the top of the long slope and was surprised and disappointed to see that it did not slope down on the other side as he had thought. Instead, it was a steep descent, much too steep to ride down. Dismounting, Falcon patted Rhoda on the neck.
You've done all I asked of you, girl. I'll take it from here.
Falcon looked down toward the track. What he saw was a freight train, consisting of an engine and about a dozen boxcars. There was no caboose. Falcon pulled his rifle out of the sheath and looked down back toward the track. That was when he saw Aaron. The outlaw, though near collapse, had somehow called upon a hidden reserve of strength. He was running now, and he managed to catch the last car. He hung on the ladder for a moment or two, then climbed to the top. Falcon sat down on the crest of the hill, and almost leisurely jacked around into the chamber of his rifle. He raised the rear sight and slid the gate up to a range marking at 500 yards. Crossing his legs and resting his left elbow just inside his left knee, he raised the rifle to his shoulder, then sighted down the long octagonal barrel. The distance opened to about 500 yards. He was shooting down, and his target was at an angle and moving at better than 20 miles per hour. It was also a little over a quarter of a mile away. To 99 men out of 100, it was such an impossible shot that they wouldn't even try. Falcon took in a deep breath, let half of the air out, then held it. Aaron was standing on top of the retreating boxcar, and he began dancing a taunting little jig. From this distance, Aaron wasn't much bigger than the front side itself. Slowly, ever so slowly, Falcon began squeezing the trigger.
Look at you now, you son of a bitch! You killed one of my brothers and caused the other one to get killed! But now I'm getting away and you're left sucking hind tit! Go ahead and shoot at me if you want to. I'm out of range, you dumb shit.
Aaron felt a blow in the center of his chest. He had only a moment to be surprised before he fell from the train. Falcon McAllister was not one for parties.
It would mean a lot to me, Falcon, if you would come. It's not only a celebration of the rescue of Anna, it's also sort of an epiphany for me.
An epiphany?
An awakening of sorts, from my long period of grief. There will always be a place in my heart for Alice, but life must go on. Of course, I don't have to tell you that, do I? We share that tragedy, you and I.
It was that remark, the shared tragedy remark, that convinced Falcon to come to the party. But now, as he dismounted in front of Elkhorn, he began having second thoughts. And had it been anyone else but Roosevelt, he would have remounted and ridden away. Not one to do things halfway, Roosevelt had hired a band, and the music spilled out onto the lawn where several partygoers were congregating under the trees or around the gazebo. One of Roosevelt's hands was cooking half a steer, turning it on a spit over an open fire. Another hand was brushing the glistening steer carcass with a sauce of some sort. Falcon had to admit that the aroma was very enticing.
Falcon! I was beginning to fear that you might not come.
I confess having second thoughts about it, but a promise is a promise.
Indeed it is. And that was what allayed my fears. Come, let's go into the house.
As if by a prearranged signal, that brought all the other guests inside the house, where they crowded around in the great room.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Judge Andrew Heckmeyer.
Heckmeyer climbed up on a wooden chair so he would have a commanding enough position to be seen by all in the room. Anna, beaming brightly, was standing beside the chair.
Ladies and gentlemen, those of you who know me might know that it is very difficult for me to ever say I was wrong. In fact, you might even say that I'm a little stubborn.
Stubborn? You, Daddy? Surely you jest.
Heckmeyer held out his hands for silence.
All right. I'm a lot stubborn. Which, I hope, gives more weight to what I'm about to say. Mr. McAllister, you, sir, are indeed the stuff of legends. A Western icon and an American hero. I hereby publicly confess that my former opinion of you was wrong. And I apologize for any negative thing I ever said or thought about you.
Please, no apologies needed.
But you do accept it, I hope.
I do accept it.
When Heckmeyer stepped down from the chair with his hand extended, Falcon accepted it and shook it heartily.
Mr. McAllister, I hope you know that if there is ever anything I can do for you, anything at all, I'll do it.
Well, thank you, Judge. I appreciate that.
Roosevelt climbed up on the chair next, and when he didn't get the immediate attention of all, he put his fingers to his lips.
I also have something to say. Falcon, I have an appointment for you.
An appointment?
I confess it is a meaningless appointment unless you would happen to move to the state of New York, but I hope you will accept it with the honor it is intended to convey.
Roosevelt unfurled a scroll and began to read.
In accordance with the authority vested in me as governor of the state of New York, I, David P. Hill, do hereby appoint Falcon McAllister to the rank of Colonel of Cavalry in the New York Militia. Congratulations, Colonel McAllister.
Thanks. Don't know what to say.
I knew you wouldn't accept money, so this is all I could think of. I hope you like it.
I do like it. Colonel McAllister, that sounds good. To be honest, I like it probably more than I should.
All right, friends. Let the party begin. We've a lot of work to do tonight. We have half a steer to consume.
With Roosevelt's announcement, many hurried outside to get in line for the barbecue. During the course of the party, so many came by to congratulate Falcon that he finally was forced to slip outside and walk over to the shadows of the far edge of the yard. He was only there for a few minutes when he felt a presence. Turning around, he saw Anna.
Thank you for Rhoda. She is beautiful. You're sure I can keep her?
I'm sure.
I haven't told anyone.
Told anyone what?
That I killed a man.
You don't need to.
I can't get it out of my mind.
You had no choice.
That's what I've been telling myself. Still, I'm having a difficult time dealing with it.
You'll have difficulty for a while. But you're a strong woman, and you'll come to accept it had to be done.
How do you deal with such things? I mean, you've killed so many. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that the way it sounded.
Well, that's all right. It's a good question, and under circumstances you've every right to ask.
All right. I'll ask again. How do you deal with it?
When an apple goes bad, there's nothing left of the original fruit. The rot so poisons the thing that you have to throw the entire apple away in order to get rid of the rot. Men are like that. When their soul becomes infested with evil, there's nothing you can do but get rid of the evil. Just remember, you ain't killing the man. The man has already died. You're only killing the evil.
Thank you. Thank you. That will help.
You're welcome.
Well, I guess I had better go back to the party now. Are you coming back?
In a little while.
After Anna left, Falcon remained outside. A breeze came up. It was colder than it had been, and he knew that the long, lingering days of a warm fall were just about over. It would be winter soon, and snow would close the passes. He would head south in the morning. Falcon had never much cared for the cold.
Destiny of Eagles is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2004, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by David Coyne, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, Thomas Penny, Christopher Graybill, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael Replogle, Jim Lawson, Dylan Lynch, Michael Glenn, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, Kate Torrey, James Konacek, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Casey Jones. Additional original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Destiny of Eagles, be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's Bloodbond series, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for another episode of Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator. Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator by Ido Van Belkom. Copyright 2007, Ido Van Belkom. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode 5, Murder on Sight.
The drive back east across the prairies was uneventful, and considering the string of adventures he'd experienced of late, Mark Dalton was grateful for the respite. When he reached Sudbury, he made a call on his cell phone to find out exactly where he was supposed to deliver the wind machines to, and to make sure there would be someone to meet him when he got there later in the day. The movie was being shot in and around Collingwood, and the cast and crew had taken over an inn just a few kilometers away in a town called Nottawa. That's where he was supposed to deliver his load. When he got to the inn around 3 that afternoon, he parked on the road out in front of the place and headed inside. He was on the lookout for Shannon Tweed, the sexy star of the movie, but figured she was probably on the set somewhere, acting up a storm.
I'll call you later.
Still, maybe he'd get lucky. The production company had taken over the inn's lobby, using it like a command center. There was a storyboard on one wall, filming schedules on another, and a few tables with clipboards and other items that looked like they helped keep track of things. But for all the clutter in the room, there wasn't a soul in sight.
Hello? Anybody here? Hello?
From a room off the lobby, he could hear someone talking, probably on a phone because the shouts were punctuated by long pauses. Mark headed for the sound of the voice and ended up in the inn's bar. There was a young man sitting on a stool with a cell phone to his ear. He was talking about a lot of things Mark didn't understand or cared about, since none of the words he was saying were Shannon Tweed. Mark lingered on the periphery, waiting for the guy to get off the phone.
Hey, what do you want?
Hey, my name's Mark Dalton. I've got your wind machines on the back of my truck.
Never mind. The guy's here right now. What took you so long?
Shipping bill said Friday. Today's Friday.
Yeah, well, I could have used them this morning.
Then you should have asked for them on Thursday.
Yeah.
Are you the director?
Sort of. I'm the second unit director. Steve Zaks. I'm directing all the snowstorm scenes.
Where'd you want me to bring the wind machines, then?
I'll draw you a map.
Mark went over to the bar, and Steve drew a simple map that would take him to the site of tomorrow's shoot. A tree-lined hill midway between Collingwood and Stainer.
Look, there are a few trucks on the road now waiting for the site to be cleared. Pull in behind the last one in the line and wait there. I'll be up later to supervise the setup.
Can you sign for the load?
No, the production manager's up there. She'll sign when the machines are in position. Is there a problem?
No, not really. I hear Shannon Tweed is in this movie.
That's right.
Will she be there?
She did 2 days on location a week ago. Then she did 2 weeks in studio in Toronto. She's probably back in L.A. by now, working on her tan.
Oh, thanks.
It was a short drive to the location shoot, and Mark had no trouble finding the other trucks parked on the side of the road that led to the site. There was a semi-trailer up front, and a Kenworth medium-duty cab over directly in front of him. The engines were running on both trucks, so Mark decided to let his Peterbilt idle while he caught up on the local news with a copy of the Barry Examiner he'd picked up at a coffee shop about a half hour outside of Collingwood. Apparently, the movie production was big news. What with the ski season just about over and still a few months to go before the summer crowd descended on the area. A few cars drove by in both directions while Mark read the paper, but there was no sign of movement from the lead truck, so Mark lost himself in the news. He made it halfway through the paper when he heard the familiar cry of a Cummins, then looked up to see a plume of black smoke rise up from the lead rig's twin stacks. Mark shifted into first and waited for the truck in front of him to start moving. He waited there as the lead truck pulled away and disappeared around a curve in the road. But the truck directly in front of him didn't budge.
Come on, pal.
Hey, buddy. The clutch is on the left, and the gear shift is that long thing on the right with the knob on the end of it.
Pleased with his own joke, Mark waited for a response, but he didn't get one. He tried again, this time reaching up and grabbing the driver's jacket sleeve, hoping to get his attention.
Listen, man, I...
The driver tumbled out of the open cab into Mark's arms. His eyes were wide open and glassy, and his face was pale white, as if it had been drained of blood. Mark eased the man to the ground, then saw the knife handle sticking out of a bloody hole in the man's chest. Mark looked up and saw that there was blood dripping out of the truck cab and was likely pooled all over the floor of it.
AD.
Hang on, pal. I'll call for an ambulance.
Mark got up to head back to his rig where he left his cell phone, but he didn't even manage a step. Parked next to his rig was an OPP cruiser, lights flashing.
Drop the knife!
The cop's gun pointed directly at Mark's head. Mark wanted to say something, tell the cop it wasn't how it looked, but he decided it wasn't time to be difficult with the police. He put down the knife, and moments later, he was in handcuffs. The interview room at the OPP Communication Center in Barrie was small, cramped, and surprisingly clean. Mark had expected something right out of NYPD Blue, but then this was rural Ontario, and such rooms probably didn't get as much use as their counterparts in Midtown Manhattan.
You were caught with the knife in your hand. There were no other fingerprints on the knife handle but yours.
I was pulling the knife out of the man's chest.
After you stuck it in?
No, I didn't stab him.
Just tell me why you did it.
I didn't kill him.
All right then. Tell me what did happen.
I've already told you 12 times.
Let's make it lucky 13.
After I arrived at the inn, I was told by the second unit director to drive up to the location.
He recounted the story just as it happened, never stumbling over any of the details, never changing anything about the story. It was easy, since when you're telling the truth, the story is the same each and every time you tell it.
All right. He died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, which means he was still alive when you found him. Did he say anything to you?
Mark hadn't mentioned it up until now, because what the man had said seemed to be gibberish, and the cop hadn't yet asked him anything other than why he killed the man. Now that it seemed like the cop was willing to admit that he wasn't the killer, Mark was more inclined to help him with the case and tell him about the dying man's last words.
I can't be sure. He said something that sounded like aid or 80 or something like that.
You sure?
That's what it sounded like to me.
Any idea about what it's supposed to mean?
I don't know. He knew he was dying. Maybe he was saying adios.
D'Alessandro shook his head, obviously not appreciating Mark's line of reasoning.
You might want to take a look at this, Joe.
According to this, you're fairly well acquainted with a number of police forces across the country.
Okay, so I've been mixed up in a few things I shouldn't have, but come on, guys. I've never been charged with anything close to murder, not even assault.
The two cops looked at each other and seemed willing to concede the point. Mark sensed he was getting somewhere with D'Alessandro and decided to keep talking.
Most of the times, I wind up helping the cops.
Like in Vancouver a few days ago?
And as far as this guy who got killed goes...
Josh Peden.
As far as this Josh Peden goes, I never met him before, so I've got no motive. I just arrived in Collingwood, so I had no opportunity to plan a murder. And if I did do it, I would have used the bat I keep in my truck, not a knife.
Mark immediately regretted mentioning this last little bit, but nevertheless, it seemed to help make his point.
Don't go anywhere.
D'Alessandro followed the other cop out of the room. Mark sat for 2 hours trying to put what little pieces he had together. Finally, D'Alessandro returned to release him.
We might need to talk to you again about this case. Don't leave town.
Hey, I'm a trucker. It's my job to leave town.
Then I guess you're going to be out of a job for a while.
The police were kind enough to drive Mark back to his rig. It was still sitting there by the side of the road, the wind machine still up on the flatbed.
You Mark Dalton?
Yeah, who are you?
Karen Fernandez.
Ah, you're supposed to sign for my load.
I'd be happy to do that for you, but I want to talk to you about something else first.
I didn't do it.
I didn't say you did.
All right then.
Look, the cops mentioned to me that they didn't want you going anywhere for a while.
Yeah?
Yeah, so I was wondering if you might want to work for us as a driver for a few days. As you know, we're suddenly short one driver.
What kind of driving would I have to do?
You'd be moving the wind machines around to wherever we need them for one, but mostly you'd be driving one of the vans that shuttle our people from the inn to the location shoots.
Mark wanted to jump at the chance at hanging around a movie set for a few days, but didn't want to look too eager.
So what's it pay?
It's not union scale, but this is a non-union shoot. That's good for you, because I wouldn't be able to hire you otherwise.
Union or non-union, it was more than he would have been making sitting around waiting for the cops to let him leave town.
Yeah, sure, I guess that'd be all right.
Good. Now, let's get these wind machines off the road and onto the site.
After Mark got the wind machines on site, he left his rig at the location and got a ride back to the inn from one of the other shuttle bus drivers. When he got to the inn, the production manager's assistant gave him the keys to a 10-year-old Chrysler Magic Wagon parked out behind the inn.
Now what do I do?
Get the motor running and wait out front. You'll basically be shuttling people back and forth from the chute, or anywhere else they need to go.
It sounded easy enough, and it was always nice to carry a load that didn't have his fingerprints all over it.
If you're hungry, you can pick up something with the rest of the crew, but if you're not around when they break for lunch, you're on your own. Away you go, then.
Mark went to the lot behind the inn, where he saw the older minivan parked in among some newer vehicles. As he approached, he realized the van had been a school bus at one point and had probably seen better days. And that became painfully obvious when he got in behind the wheel and tried to start it up. Mark made a mental note, not to shut off the engine if he didn't have to, and maybe take a look under the hood if he had time. He was kept waiting out in front of the inn for 15 minutes, but that gave the van a chance to warm up both inside and under the hood. His first passengers were a pair of young women in neat little ski outfits that had been ripped and torn by the costume people. The women had also been made up and featured blue frostbitten lips and rough red scrapes on their faces and cuts and bruises to the rest of their exposed flesh. After the girls got in, one of them tried pulling the sliding door shut, but it wasn't closing right. Mark got out of the van, went around to the passenger side, and shut the door. When he got back into the van, the girls were talking about the dead driver. Mark listened in.
He was so cute.
I heard he was with Adriana Spencer.
But she's with the director.
She is now, but she had a fling with the driver before him.
Well, I can't blame her.
Did you hear they arrested the driver's partner?
They did?
Sure did. He had a set of keys to the truck, and they'd had a fight in the bar just last night. I saw that myself.
What's his name?
Who, the dead guy?
No, his partner.
I think it's Arnold Dickens.
Mark felt the hairs stand up on the back of his neck. A.D. had been the dying man's last words. Arnold Dickens. A.D. A.D. When he reached the location of the chute, he dropped off the girls and picked up an electrician who he had to drive to Barrie to pick up some supplies.
Shouldn't you have those things on site?
We should, and on any other shoot we would, but the producer's been cutting every nickel and dime on this one.
Look, I don't know much about movies, but it looks to me as though there's plenty of money being thrown around.
Well, he's spending plenty of money on some things, like 2 weeks' work from Shannon Tweed, like the wind machine rental, but he went non-union to cut down on crew costs. This guy makes Roger Corman look like a fat cat. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's in trouble with the film board when this is all over.
Maybe the driver had something on the producer and was going to report him. That might ruin the guy's career, and that was certainly a motive for murder.
What's this producer's name?
Adianus. Joseph H. Adianus.
Mark shifted nervously in his seat. Joseph H. Adianus. Adianus. A.D. After returning from Barrie and dropping the electrician on location, he was sent back to the inn to pick up the stuntman who was the star of the scene they were about to shoot. But while Mark was expecting a stuntman, he actually picked up a man who bore a striking resemblance to Shannon Tweed.
No offense, pal, but you remind me a lot of Shannon Tweed.
And 3 hours in makeup didn't go to waste.
The gruff voice was all out of sync with the voluptuous curves of his ski suit, the long blonde locks, and his ruby red lips.
Are you doing a stunt for her?
Nah. I'm taking a fall for the woman who plays Tweed's younger sister in the movie. It's just a 5-foot fall into a snowbank, but the director doesn't want to risk his new piece getting hurt.
His new girlfriend? You mean the one that had been with the dead truck driver?
Yeah, I guess she's the one. Seems like the kind that might get tired of a man after a while.
But she's been with the director for some time now.
Couple of days, a week maybe.
If you don't mind me asking, who is the director anyway?
You kidding me? Abram Doyle Kelso. He did Newts in Your Pants?
Oh, him.
Abram Doyle Kelso. Abram Doyle. A.D. When he reached the site, Mark was asked to wait a few minutes for someone. He waited 10 minutes before a young actress got into the van. She had trouble closing the sliding door, so Mark had to get out and help her get it shut. She was pretty enough to be a star, and he could swear that he'd seen her somewhere before.
Are you one of the stars in this movie?
Not of this movie, sugar.
I sense a sarcastic tone.
It's just that I'm not about to make a name for myself by sleeping with the director. It might take a bit longer, but I'm going to make it on my talent.
You mean like the woman who's with the director now?
How did you know? She's an ambitious one. She'd give it up for anyone who she thinks can advance her career. Can you believe it? She even slept with one of the drivers because he told her he was a good friend of another director.
How do you know that?
You think he didn't try the line on me?
But she's with the director now, and she got a better part, right?
Yeah, she got the part, but her kind will do anything to be in the movies. It worked this time, but she doesn't have the talent to back it up. She might be Doyle's plaything this week, but next week someone else will be playing that role.
Plenty of women like her, huh?
Mister, I know a dozen girls who would kill to get a better part in a movie.
Really? What's this woman's name? You know, so I'll know it when the movie comes out.
Adriana Spencer, with an S, like the private eye.
Adriana, A.D. Mark shook his head. Who wasn't a suspect? After a good night's sleep at the inn, Mark was up early running errands before he was scheduled to start shuttling people back and forth from the location. After picking up some dry cleaning in Barry, he decided to see if he could see the truck driver they had in custody. It was a long shot, but if he could convince the police that he knew this driver, they might let him see him.
Hi, I'm Mark Dalton. I replaced the driver that was killed. I need to speak to the driver you've charged with the other's murder.
Are you a friend of his?
Mark wondered what to say. He didn't even know the guy's name.
No. It's just that I've got to move his truck, and I can't find the reverse on it. I need to ask him, you know, where it is.
The look on the officer's face said, "What kind of truck driver are you?" Mark realized he had to bore the man with detail.
Yeah, you see, on a Peterbilt, the gear configuration is similar to that.
McNeil!
Yeah? Take this guy to see that driver we charged with murder. Give him 2 minutes, then show him the door.
The younger cop nodded, and Mark was on his way.
You a lawyer?
No, just a driver.
I need a lawyer to get me out of here.
Well, I might just get you out of here just the same.
What do you want?
I want to know about your partner.
Know what?
Like, was he having money problems?
With this job, we were doing great. The pay's good. We're not putting any miles in the trucks. Josh said he wanted to buy another rig, hire a third driver, and start to make our little company grow. We had money, sure, but not enough for a new rig. But Josh says not to worry, and he'll be coming into some money soon, so financing wasn't going to be a problem.
Where was he going to get the money from?
I don't know. He didn't really have a head for money. See, he was a good-looking guy, but dumb as a post. Where he got into trouble all the time was with women, like with that actress. Her so young and pretty, and him so big and dumb. If I were the cops, I'd take a look at her.
So, reverse is on the right, then down in the corner.
Huh?
Got it, thanks.
The cop led him out of the station. When he got into the van, he thought about what he'd learned. So the driver, Josh, was expecting a windfall of cash, and then he's dead. And somehow the girl was involved. But how? Mark didn't have to wonder for long. His first passenger of the day was the very girl in question, Adriana Spencer. She was young, really young, pretty too, and had a body that was every bit as curvaceous as Shannon Tweed's. That was obvious even though she was wearing a ski suit. No wonder the director had taken a shine to her.
Morning. You're Adriana Spencer, right?
That's right. Hi, Mom. No, they're not doing anything to celebrate it. Doyle doesn't want to make a big deal about it. He says we'll be celebrating in Cancun after the film wraps.
Mom, you're breaking up. I'll call you later.
Celebrating a birthday?
Yes.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
How old do you have to be to drink in Ontario?
19.
Then that's how old I am. 19.
Oh, so you're born in 1972, huh?
That's right.
Mark didn't really think he'd catch her so easily, but there it was. If she was 19, she'd have corrected him and said 1971. But she agreed she was born in 1972, which made today her 18th birthday, and which also made her just 17 the day before. No wonder the director, Doyle, didn't want to make a big deal about her birthday, and no wonder the driver, Josh, had been murdered. When he arrived at the location, Mark dropped Adriana Spencer off.
Happy birthday, and break a leg.
He took a few extras back to the inn, and then picked up the second unit director, Steve Zax, to take him out to the location as well. He seemed to be in a hurry, and a little bit on edge.
You're the second unit director, right? I met you yesterday.
Yeah, hi.
I've only been working in movies for a day, but I've learned that sometimes the second unit director is also called the assistant director.
Boy, you learn fast.
But not too many people call it assistant director. They just call it AD.
That's me.
Huh. So how's the movie going?
Very well, actually. 2 more days of shooting, and then 2 weeks editing, and it'll all be done. And I'll be back here in December, shooting Snowflake 2.
You know that already, huh? Doesn't the first one have to make money first?
See, the way we shot it on the cheap, it's already turned a profit with rights sales to Japan, Russia, and Brazil. The deal for the sequel was inked yesterday, and I'm going to direct it.
Dalton felt a chill creep up the back of his spine.
So I guess it was really important to you that this shoot went off without a hitch, right?
Yes.
And the murder of that driver was probably a close one, in terms of the movie getting finished and all.
What do you mean?
Well, any adverse publicity and the whole production might get shut down. The movie would be left hanging and there'd be no Snowflake 2. No big break for you.
I suppose.
So, if there was something that might screw up the film, you'd really want to make it right.
What the hell are you getting at?
Like, if that driver was going to blackmail you about how the director was sleeping with a minor, that could throw the whole movie into the toilet. What with all the nudity in it.
Shut the hell up!
Hey, I'm just talking here.
But the AD was through talking. He had a knife in his hand now, much like the knife Mark had pulled from the dead man's chest. Mark turned the wheel wildly, left and right, trying to throw the man in the backseat off balance. It was working, but only a little. The sliding door had rolled open, and the man's knife was ripping through the driver's seat, coming dangerously close to Mark's arm. Mark leaned forward in the seat and could hear the knife tearing through the backrest behind him. He'd only been asking a few questions, trying to figure out the puzzle in his head. He never dreamed he would stumble upon the murderer, and right now he wished to God his involvement in the movie business consisted of popcorn, soda, and an aisle seat. The guy was still slashing wildly at him from the back seat. The only thing saving Mark's life was the fact that the man wasn't wearing a seatbelt and couldn't hold the knife steadily enough to deal a lethal blow.
That damn idiot Doyle! I told him, keep it in your pants till her birthday! But he couldn't resist that bitch! Never once thought about me, my career!
Another slash tore into the seat behind Mark, and he could feel the knife tip press against the small of his back. The next one was going to go right through the seat. He began honking the horn since he was rapidly approaching the chute. There were a couple of people milling around, even a couple of cops on hand to keep an eye on things. Mark stepped on the gas and headed for the police and their cruiser. People began to scatter. About 50 yards away from the cruiser, Mark turned the wheel hard to the left and jumped on the brake pedal with both feet. The minivan's rear end swung out as the tires screamed against the asphalt. For a moment, it looked as if the vehicle might topple over. But then it came to an abrupt halt, sending Steve Zax, AD, flying out the open door like a drunk after closing time. He rolled head over heels over head several times before coming to a halt at the feet of two constables. Mark knew right then that his career in the movies was finished. And he was glad of it.
Be sure to look for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. In August, Mark Dalton Episode 6 appears in Deathlands No. 25, The Executioner No. 319, and Doomsday Warrior No. 3.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.